Now, when I was off there at Easter, I read a great book by an Irish author. The book is called 10 Days. The author is Austin Duffy, and Austin is on the line now. How are you doing, Austin?
Oh, great, Ray. Thanks, and yourself?
Good. Congratulations on the book.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah, the great story, which we'll get to in a moment, you yourself have a great story because not only do you write books, but you're an oncologist.
That's right, yeah. I'm an oncologist. I work at the Mater and also UCD as well. And, I've been doing that for a number of years. A lot of the time I spent in the United States, actually.
Okay.
I did all my training, medical training and so forth in Ireland and grew up in Dundalk. Did all my training here.
Can I bring you back to Dundalk for a minute? Because I'm interested in this. Because I have a hunch that in a lot of schools in Ireland, just because you could get enough points for medicine, that's why you did it. It wasn't because you particularly wanted to do it or that you, you know, had a burning ambition to be a doctor. It was because, you know, you were the brightest in the class or thereabouts and you could get the points, so you did medicine. Was that the story with you?
Yeah, I kind of think you're right. I sort of went into medicine like that. I mean, back then, I don't remember at that age thinking that there were a whole pile of other options we could do. I mean, obviously the world is a different place now, but it seemed like a good idea. I mean, I couldn't think of a better alternative.
Had you an ambition to be a writer when you were at secondary school?
I wouldn't go that far. I had an amazing English teacher, absolutely amazing. A guy by the name of Sidney Peck. He was a Canadian fella, and he came in midway through, I think it was our second year. And he was kind of an irreverent sort, you know. It very similar to the guy in Dead Poets Society, you know.
Robin Williams.
Very similar. Yeah. It's almost a cliche, but it's sort of true. And Sidney Peck, he came in. He was very funny, irreverent, and he just got us all energized in writing. And I got into it big time, you know. I just used to spend all weekend working on the school essays, you know. Before Sidney, it would have been totally boring, you know. And I just got into it. But I don't know if I'd say, I can honestly say I wanted to be a writer. I probably didn't even know that that was a possibility, you know.
Yeah.
So I ended up going down a different path for a while.
So you studied medicine in Trinity College.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, as often happens, you qualify and you have to go outside of Ireland to get better qualifications. So you ended up in New York.
Yeah, I ended up in New York. To cut a long story short, I ended up in New York in 2006. So this is after I did all my, junior doctor training and oncology training, on-the-job training, really, in Ireland. And 2006, I was lucky, actually. I won a sort of a scholarship award to go to Memorial Sloan Kettering. It's a famous cancer hospital on the Upper East Side.
Right.
And so I find myself over there and I was living, they put me in this very basic accommodation. I was just so happy to be there. I would have stayed anywhere. And it was in a sort of a bed sit, what we call a bed sit, a studio apartment, very basic on the hospital grounds. I'd no television, I'd no internet. And I thought I'd always had, like lots of people, I suppose, I always had this sort of hankering that, to get back into the writing and to do it seriously and all that never came to anything. So I thought here I found myself in New York with no distractions, really, other than New York itself and the work. And I thought, well, if I'm ever going to do it, I might as well do it now. So I joined this, I came across this organization called the Writer's Studio down in Greenwich Village. And they were amazing. You know, I just got into it and it was just a one night a week job thing. But whatever exercises they said, I just took to it like a duck to water and really, really loved it and started doing it every day. And then the writing just became part of my life, you know. And
when you say you were writing every day, what were you writing? I know that sounds like a really stupid question, but
no, it's not actually. It's right on the money because that's the thing about doing the Writer's Studio and basically they taught creative writing. So they would set exercises,
okay,
and you would work on the exercises. And and then it's up to you. You know, you could just do the exercise and then forget about it. But I kind of got into it and started doing it every single day. And I think it was just the point of having this external, you know, contact where they would be setting you these sort of tasks, and you know, it just all sort of kicked in. Whereas if you're on your own trying to be a writer, as you said, it's very hard. What do you write about, and where do you start? And that was the bit I struggled.
But that was the worst thing at school, wasn't it? You know, write an essay about anything. No, tell me what to write an essay about, please. Please be prescriptive. Thank you very much. So it's parallel. You're advancing in the area of oncology, and you're developing as a writer. So how long did it take you to write your first book, This Living and Immortal Thing?
Yeah, it took. Oh my God, it must have took about 6 or 7 years. And you know, when I tell people that, they expect to see this big massive tome, you know, but it's actually not at all. It's like a small.
Again, I have to ask this. You know, so just talk me through how it takes 6 or 7 years.
Well, the first few years it was learning the craft of writing. I mean, it was total nonsense. The book itself was awful for so long, you know. I mean, it was all sorts of. I went down all sorts of rabbit holes and blind alleyways, and that was just, in hindsight, that was just me learning, you know, how to do it, you know. And I mean, for most of that time, it was not worth reading in any shape or form. But gradually, it got a bit better. At one point, actually, what was a big inflection point was I won the Francis McManus
The short story award. Competition
And that was big. It was a shot in the arm, because at that stage I'd been writing for, you know, 4 or 5 years. And on my own, you know, with no one other than my wife knew I was writing, really. And this is this was a sort of a validation a little bit. Yeah. And also, I have to say, as a result of that, I got contacted by an editor who was really then helpful and constructive, and reviewed the manuscript on several occasions. And he ultimately passed on it. He was absolutely instrumental to and pointed me in the right direction. Otherwise, I'd still be down one of those rabbit holes, to be honest with you.
You've been lucky with your teacher, with that amazing name. He sounds like he should be in a movie. And then the group in New York, and then this editor. And all of this time, you're developing as an oncologist, and you meet Naomi, your wife, in New York, is it?
That's right. Yeah. Naomi's from New York. She's grew up in the Bronx, Riverdale in the Bronx. And yeah, we met in a place called the Arch Students League. It's one of these great public institutions they have in New York, where you can go and pay not very much money to do painting. And she's an artist, Naomi, and we met there. And we sort of got together. And then my fellowship, it was a 2-year thing at Memorial that came to an end. And we just met, so luckily I got offered a position down in Washington, D.C., working for what's called the National Cancer Institute, which is basically the U.S. federal government's research arm, you know. Okay. And so we went down there. It worked out on a personal level and also career-wise, and so we sort of moved down there. We got married, our kids were born, and we were very happy in Washington, actually. Ended up spending 9 years there. And it was just brilliant. Before I managed to talk Naomi into coming, and the kids into moving back to Ireland.
Oh, Dublin. The kids didn't have much choice now. What age were they, in fairness?
You'd be surprised. my son is 8 now, and my daughter is 5.
Okay, so 10 Days is the new book. And you draw on your experience in New York, because New York is a character in the book, and I know that sounds a little bit up its own behind, but it is. It's you know, your knowledge of New York, obviously, it's there in every page or every second page, and Naomi's background, you borrow from that as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so Naomi's Jewish, and so when we met, you know, that was obviously something that, you know, I was sort of experiencing it for the first time. I'd never really met, you know, growing up in Ireland and all, there are some Jewish people around for sure, and there used to be more back in the day, but I wasn't really familiar with that faith at all. And meeting Naomi and all her family was the first introduction to that, going to all the family events, the religious events. In the Jewish faith, there seems to be one every week, you know, it's great. And, you know, so that was all a big educational experience to me. Luckily, in a positive way, you know, it's never really, it's never been a point of conflict, you know.
Yeah, because there is conflict in the book. So
yeah,
Wolf,
well, there kind of has to be, yeah, you know. Yeah, I mean, if I wrote a novel where everybody was just grand, you know.
You should try it, see how it goes.
Yeah, I have. It doesn't work out.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the happy ever after doesn't work out. There you go. Yeah. So Wolf is the main character. His wife Miriam, who's Jewish, has died, and Wolf and his daughter Ruth travel to New York to spread her ashes on the Hudson River, and that's the basic. And the 10 days refers to the 10 days in New York. And there's a twist. You can say as much about it as you like. I don't want to give it away.
No, sure. I mean, yeah, you captured it very nicely there. Yeah, that's the premise of the book is this guy Wolf, whose wife has just died, and he's traveling to New York with her ashes to take part in a ceremony where he'll spread the ashes on the Hudson. Now, his ex-wife, Miriam, who's died, was from the Jewish faith, and she was also from New York. So this is obviously where I was borrowing from Naomi's family and so forth. But the difference here, of course, is that in the Jewish faith, you know, cremation is very much frowned upon. It's not part of the Jewish tradition, really.
Why is that?
I'm not sure. I think it's something to do with having to maintain the integrity of the body,
right,
you know, for, you know, the return, for the coming of the Messiah or the Savior or whatever. But, you know, and that, so the body needs to be intact. I think that's the rationale for it.
Okay.
And but it's certainly not traditional, and that's a bone of contention with the family. Also, you know, the fact he isn't on good terms with his in-laws and the wider family. He hasn't seen them in 20 years. So there's bad blood there, bad feeling. And he's traveling over with, you know, ostensibly, you know, just for this short trip. The sort of, as the book moves on, it becomes apparent that there's this ulterior motive for the trip to do with his daughter. And basically he intends, you know, to transfer her care to the in-laws for reasons that sort of become clear as the book evolves. And of course, he keeps this a secret from the daughter and also from the family. And that is sort of explained as the sort of book progresses, because he's got a serious issue that he's kept to himself and he's trying to deal with. And ultimately, he's going to need help with.
Yeah. You know, you write very well, because your children aren't that age yet, but I think you write very well describing the relationship and the scenes with Wolf and his daughter, because it's fractious and it's uneasy.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're both of them are grieving as well. So it's all very well written.
Thank you.
10 days, Austin Duffy. Can I talk to you a little bit about oncology, the other side of your life?
Sure.
Yeah,
of course.
So you're back and you're in the Mater and UCD, and you're practicing as well as researching. Is that it?
Yeah, that's pretty much it. I mean, I'm a medical oncologist, so basically I see folks with cancer, various stages of cancer. Either, you know, they might have had an operation to try and cure the cancer, and you're giving them treatment afterwards, or, you know, the other folks who have disease that's more advanced than that, and you're giving them drugs, either chemotherapy or other types of drugs to try and contain the cancer and treat it, and basically look after and mind them and make sure they have all they need. And so that would be sort of the sort of day-to-day kind of standard.
It's an ever-evolving area of medicine, isn't it? And there are new drugs coming on the market every second month. The drug that people will know, I suppose, is pembrolizumab, because it made famous by Vicky Phelan, and she'd prefer to be famous for other reasons, obviously. But so it was that a revolutionary drug in its time, and has its position been overtaken?
Oh, so yeah, it's not just that drug itself, but yeah, the short answer would be yes, and almost to both questions. It was absolutely revolutionary and remains revolutionary. But basically what that drug is a type of what we call immunotherapy,
right,
which is basically the short sort of explanation for that is an attempt to get patients' own immune systems to fight against their cancer. So traditionally we treat cancer, you know, for with surgery, obviously, is probably the oldest, well, definitely the oldest type of anti-cancer treatment. People have been operating on tumours for thousands of years. And with some refinement, thankfully, over time. And then, of course, you had radiation treatment, which has been around, you know, for 100 years. And, of course, has been refined and refined. Mm. And then chemotherapy is the other obvious traditional anti-cancer treatment. And they're the main types of anti-cancer treatment that still exist and we use all of the time. Immunotherapy is kind of a different concept. And it's basically, it's almost like where you're not even actually trying to treat the cancer directly. You're actually treating the person's immune system and trying to get that immune system interested in their cancer.
Okay.
And to get it to
attack the cancer. So it's like putting up a signpost directing the immune system towards the tumor.
So yeah, pretty much. And right. And pembrolizumab is one of these drugs, and it's a major drug, and it's produced major benefits. You mentioned Vicky Phelan's case and it's really changed the game, and particularly in cancers such as melanoma or lung cancer, and you know, cervical cancer, you know, other cancers, and it's absolutely terrific when it works, you know. The second part of your question was, well, you know, has its position been overtaken? Yeah, it's not so much that it's been overtaken. I mean, when it works, when the pembrolizumab or drugs like it, immune drugs, when they work, or if they work really, really well. The question is, how do we get them to work in other diseases or in those other patients in whom it's not working for whatever reason,
yes, yes.
Or in whom it has stopped working? And that's kind of where the field is at the moment. And there's
can
so
I,
much.
Can I ask you
and,
a sort of a, yeah? a philosophical question about cancer treatment?
Sure.
If there is a person who has been diagnosed with terminal cancer, and if there is a drug that's at the early stages of development but hasn't been okayed by the EMA or whatever the FDA, whatever the equivalent is in America or whatever the equivalent is here, if that person is going to die anyway, should they not treat that person with that drug?
Yeah, well, so it depends. I probably wouldn't phrase it quite like that. In that, yeah, this is the second part of my job, really, which is to do that, is to provide that mechanism where patients can get access to drugs that might not have been approved yet, but which look exciting. The proper way to do that is to do it within the context where you have monitoring and proper informed consent. And that's basically, you know, the other part of my job, which is the academic sort of research part. And this is where, you know, what I'm very invested in doing is in opening what are called early phase clinical trials. And that's jargon, obviously, but that's basically what you're talking about, where you can actually provide access of drugs that you mentioned, drugs that look promising, but that aren't approved by whoever, FDA, EMA or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, they're not, because it takes 10, 15 years to get a drug to full market approval. So you're right, you know, what do we do? Just wait around for 10, 15 years for these drugs to become approved? No, that's not much help. So so absolutely, we need a mechanism to be able to treat or offer a drug that looks exciting, you know, to patients in that situation.
Okay.
You have to do it properly, though. You can't just give.
No,
you
know, I know.
You can't just dole it out.
Of course,
it has to
be
monitored.
Yes, yes, yes.
Because you can cause a lot of damage with these drugs too.
And the other thing is, which we've encountered loads of times on this program and other programs have as well, is the cost of these drugs.
Yeah.
Will you explain to us why they cost so much and why governments around the world can't come together and pay for the research and development so that they own the drugs at the other end?
Yeah, so that's a really good and complicated question. I mean, there's a lot of reasons why the drugs are expensive. And, you know, part of it, you can sort of have a benign outlook on it and say, well, you know, it's to cover all the R&D costs that goes into this. And for sure, you know, from a pharmacist, I don't work for a pharmaceutical company or anything, so I'm not trying to defend any position or anything. But for sure, there's a huge amount of money that has to go into the R&D side. And then developing these drugs from, you know, basic laboratory experiments all the way through toxicology and animal studies, and then through human studies to all the way through to the stage where you get a drug developed. It's hugely expensive, you know. And we only see, of course, the drugs that make it. Yes. We for every drug that makes it, there might be another 100 drugs which don't make it, which all go through the same expense. So all of that does feed into the cost, and then the cost of manufacturing and all of that. But of course, yes, I mean, the pharmaceutical companies are also, you know, looking to make money and all of that. And the best way for them to do that is to come up with a successful drug that works. In terms of, well, why don't governments do it themselves? It's just too expensive. Too costly. I mean, when I was in Washington, I worked for the NIH, the National Cancer Institute, which is part of the National Institutes of Health. The American government doesn't make its own drugs. Right, I mean, yeah. There are certain situations where they do, they do a lot of discovery. But even when they do that, they hand over the manufacturing to, you know, a third party with whatever agreement is in place. So there isn't really a government on the planet that could actually.
But if all governments, you know, I think it's like climate change and say taking on the big tech companies. It needs to be a global approach as opposed to, you know, individual countries. But anyway, that's another chat. What about charlatans preying on people who are dying of cancer?
Yeah, you know, I come across that every now and again, and it's absolutely heartbreaking, you know. You really do. I mean, the sort of stuff I'm doing in terms of trying to open these early phase trials and give access, it's hard work and it's difficult both for patients and people like me, and, you know, to do it properly. It just is with the nature of it. You know, there are people, unfortunately, out there, you know, both internationally and here, who just don't bother with any of that, you know, and just hand out whatever and charge money for it. And yeah, I've seen great harm being done. Listen, I'm very open-minded. And if someone wants to try something and it's not harmful and I don't think it's going to interact or whatever, listen, I'll review any paper. I'll talk to somebody about whatever it is, because I'm fully aware, and very humbly so on a daily basis, of the limitations of modern medicine, you know, despite the fact that I do believe we're making progress. So, you know, listen, we all have to be able to look outside the box. But for sure, there's harm that can be done. And there's places around the world which are trying to attract patients and making all sorts of promises. And what they're really doing is they're taking their money and they're stealing their time, you know. And I've seen that in action. It's not nice.
It's horrible. It's horrible.
Yes.
Because people are at their most vulnerable and they're most exposed, and these people are preying on them, and it's just
right. Yeah,
it's very ugly, very ugly. How do we call that out? I wonder. Anyway, that's another day's story as well. Austin Duffy, 10 Days is the book. A fascinating conversation about writing and about cancer. And I'm sure we'll chat again. And mind yourself. And congratulations again on the book. Thanks,
Thank
Austin.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Bye bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.